You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and Meatopia, the premier food event of the season, celebrating our meat suppliers, farmers, and butchers at Brooklyn Bridge Park, July 23rd. Watch a dozen Whole Foods Market butchers from across the country compete on stage for the title of Best Butcher. Visit www.meatopia.org for tickets and information.
Heyo, it's your host, Helen Holliman. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm hanging out in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It's another scorcher today. I've got two of the most fabulous women I know on today's show. The creators, the geniuses behind Maiden Preserves, Jams.
Hardly geniuses.
Ava Schofield, Allison Roman. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the show. So, in case you don't know what Maiden Preserves is, can you fill us in?
It is our company that we started that we basically make marmalades and preserves and jams and things of the like based on what we can get our hands on around
town.
Around town.
They're absolutely delicious. They use all local seasonal delicious fruit.
Except for the citrus, which we can't get over on the East Coast. But
well,
trust that it is organic.
No one's
and
perfect.
Delicious.
No
I know
one's
well.
Perfect, right? Some of your current offerings include grapefruit and hibiscus jam, lemon and vanilla bean, orange and bourbon, rhubarb, strawberry, and verbena. Mm-hmm. And you sell most of it out of the Brooklyn Flea. Is there any other place that you sell these preserves or jams?
We're in a few retail spots. We hooked up with this woman, Wendy Weston, who started Perfect Picnic. And she has this great concept. You call her, and she has a pre-made picnic basket for you with water, cheese, meat.
Water.
And we are in that little offering, and then we're also at her retail store. And then we also met this incredible woman, Julia Leach, who started her own pop-up store in Nolita called Chance, and she just found us at the Flea and asked us to take a few jars.
And now you're one of the hottest selling items of the Brooklyn Flea, which we will get into in a minute. Something that most of our listeners probably don't know that we all share in common, besides the fact that we're all beautiful, is that we are all former and current Momofuku milkmaids.
It's a badge of honor.
Maidens, if you will.
It's a big deal, people. It's a real big deal. Yeah. It's like being in a sorority for life.
Loud sorority.
It's the best. Eva has worked in PR, marketing, and went to the University of Rhode Island. Allison, she's from
Los Angeles.
No, I lived in North Carolina. No, you're from California. I don't know why I just said North Carolina.
It's very similar, actually. The summertime, it's like
the same thing.
You can't tell the difference.
It's like England. Allison has worked at a bunch of different amazing places, which includes Quince in San Francisco. Can you guys both kind of talk about how you got into food in the first place?
I'll go.
Go, girl.
I was really young and sort of taking college classes in various colleges around California as I moved. And nothing was really sticking, and I thought that, I mean, I loved cooking, and I loved going to the farmers markets, and I loved reading cookbooks and sort of teaching myself how to cook, but I never thought of it as, like, a viable way to earn an income or to live my life. And then I realized that it actually could be. And so I went to talked to this pastry chef at a restaurant in Los Angeles when I was 19, and I told him of my plan to go to culinary school, and we talked about the Pixies, which was his favorite band, and how he was going to save me from spending $50,000 if I came to work for him, which was a complete leap of faith because I literally knew nothing about anything. And all I knew is that I wanted to learn and that I was willing to do anything, which included working, you know, for $8 an hour cutting marshmallows in the back of a closet, pretty much, which is what I did for a while. And so I started there at this bakery called Boule, which is now defunct, but their sister restaurant, Sona, which also recently closed, which is a shame because it was a great little spot in West Hollywood. I started working there and working in restaurant service, and I sort of became in charge of, like, going to the markets in the morning and picking up the produce and sort of feeding the people in the restaurant that way. And it was a very, like, hands-on experience. There wasn't a whole lot of, this is how you do it every time, don't deviate. It was very open, and people were extremely willing to sort of teach you whatever you wanted to know, no matter how crazy the idea was. And so it was really, really inspirational place to be and place to start, I feel like, because I had no preconceived notions of how things should be. It was sort of like my mind was able to wander a lot, and it was very nurtured by the people that worked there. It was a very special place. And so from there, I mean, I was determined that that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Like, it seemed like the only option. I felt like I was learning a lot, and I felt good about what I was doing. It felt like, you know, something that I could potentially do for the rest of my life. I didn't really have any other aspirations beyond, you know, being a pastry chef somewhere at some restaurant. And then after I left Los Angeles, I decided to move to San Francisco because I wanted to stay in California and I needed a change. And so they're obviously known for their amazing produce and wonderful restaurants, and sort of like the whole like Chez Panisse dining scene at that time was sort of spilling over more into San Francisco, not so much into Berkeley. And it was a really cool place to be and a good time to go there. And so it's since like expanded and exploded with a million other awesome things since I left, but it's an amazing, amazing food city. And it was there that I became a lot more like in touch with, you know, actual farms and produce and things like that, because everything was so close. So you'd go down to the ferry building on the train and then, you know, go to the restaurant. It wasn't like you needed a car to drive everywhere. It wasn't so much of a hassle. And also the farms were, you know, minutes outside of the city, and it was really easy to get to. So yeah, that's
good. God, that yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's
what
fun.
Have I been doing these past millions of years?
I mean, cutting marshmallows in the back of a closet, I guess, gets you somewhere.
That's
sometimes
my favorite food in the whole world. I love every gambit of marshmallow, but let's not get into
show.
That because that's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
So you've got like a very, you know, kind of culinary-based background, but Eva, you have a completely different, really interesting background.
Yeah.
Go into it.
mine was a little less hands-on, more in your face. Once we're done with breakfast, let's talk about what we're eating for lunch. And while we're eating lunch, let's figure out what's happening for dinner. Because my grandparents ran a resort in the Poconos pseudo-Dirty Dancing style. Pseudo, like nobody puts Eva in the corner style. It was great. So we would go there every summer, and my grandfather was the chef. And I was too young when it happened, but they had a restaurant, a full-service restaurant, attached to the kind of motel and hotel units, and it was just all day, every day, cook, 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 cook for all of these customers, all the guests. And my mother grew up, you know, tending the soda fountain and learning how to break down meat and scooping ice cream and just serving all these like fabulous old Jewish women trail mix while they played mahjong, you know. So it was always, yeah, I hope. It was always about food and how to please people through food for my grandfather. So that just kind of trickled down the family tree. And my mother has a great background. She lived in Israel for a few years. We were talking about this. And the only really form of communication she had with her mother-in-law was through food, and was through going to the open-air markets and learning how to cook traditional Israeli dishes. And she brought that back with her to the States, and it's just always been, food has just been very omnipresent in my life. It's never been like, oh, I'm going to become this incredible pastry chef. It's just something I love, and I love hanging out with people that are really good at making incredible food.
Nobody loves to eat more than this woman I'm sitting next to. It's unbelievable. It almost diminishes when you cook for her, because every time it's the best thing she's ever had, but she really makes you believe it, and it's a real ego boost.
It's so good.
I keep her around because she makes me feel really good about myself.
That's a former PR girl there.
For yeah.
You. She's really good at selling stuff.
Yeah.
So something that, you know, I want to kind of explore with the two of you and get your thoughts is West Coast versus East Coast, Tupac versus Biggie Smalls, this idea about culinary school, whether or not you should go. On the East Coast, there tends to be a lot of talk about, you know, you got to go to culinary school before you can apprentice somewhere or stage. Yeah. I took a little time and quote unquote staged in San Francisco, and I clearly remember them telling me, no way, no how. We want to mold you to how we like it. And, you know, Allison, you're obviously a Tupac representation of that. Eva, you're more East Coast. Granted, you didn't go to culinary school, right?
No.
But what do you guys think about that? And why do you think there is this kind of divergence between the two of those things?
I think for a lot of people, it offers some extra insurance if they see on somebody's resume that they've been to school. Although I can say from meeting many people that have been to culinary school that it doesn't mean a whole lot. I think that you get from it what you put into it. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you spent a year and a half going to culinary school, if you're not the type of person that's going to really soak up what you need to learn there. And it's not going to really help you out. And especially because every place, every restaurant, every chef is different and is run differently. And each place has the best way to make everything, that it really, I think, is really pleasant not to have sort of any preconceived notions of how things should be done. This is coming from someone who didn't, but obviously I'm a little biased. But it's really nice to be able to be like, I've never boned a chicken. Like, show me how you do it. And then going to three more restaurants and learning four different ways to do this one thing and then figuring out your own style, rather than having the sort of perplexed look of being like, well, that's not how we did it in school, which I get that look quite often. I wouldn't be like, well, I know, and it's hard to tell somebody that I know you learned this in school, but promise me there's a million other practical ways of doing something. So
I've met a lot of people out here. I was really thinking about it for a hot minute, just dropping everything and going to culinary school. And then I talked to a bunch of people in the industry, and they just said, no, don't bother. If you're going to do that, trail, stage, don't spend your money, don't waste the time. And then they would follow up saying, obviously, it's not a waste of time. It's an institution that exists for a reason, and it's a great institution at that. But if you really want to get your hands dirty, just jump in head first.
Yeah. It was the best piece of advice that I ever got, was listening to that man. He's a great man.
That wise
yeah.
man, the Mr. Miyagi of food. So you guys are, again, making preserves. What are some of your favorite applications for, you know, what are you putting them on? What do you think makes them special?
Oh, God.
Here's the thing. We love them in booze.
Here's the thing.
A girl after my own
Here's
heart.
The problem. It's funny because when we sell them at the flea market, people will come up and ask which one is the best to put on a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And my heart melts a little bit. And then you explain to someone, oh, but you can put it in ice cream. You can mix it with alcohol. You can put it in yogurt. And you see their faces light up like you've just given them the secret to life. Yeah. Okay, I'll have five, please. It's great. I mean, the great thing is that Allison's teaching me so much about it, because obviously I come from a non-cooking background, but she kind of opened my eyes to the fact that it doesn't have to be black and white. You can use all of these different ingredients in different ways that will flow beautifully with other things other than just toast.
Allison, what's the weirdest thing you put your jam on?
Oh, this is not safe for radio.
No.
I was actually thinking of something involving cats, which is not unsafe, just weird. Very telling about my personality.
It's very telling. Stuff on mycat.com. Is that where you would put it?
Yeah. We own that website. Yeah. That domain
I think
name.
We bought that, yeah. Gosh, I don't know. I don't really put it on weird things. I mean, I've paired it with, like, meats and stuff, which is kind of interesting, but it's always really amazingly delicious. Like, putting it on a chicken, like a roast chicken, the lemon vanilla bean, it's transcendent.
Oh, someone put it on popcorn.
Oh, yeah?
What? Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Oh, Bring them to
that
me.
That is crazy.
Like a popcorn glaze, and I couldn't wrap my head around it, so I went home and tried it. It's good.
It was good, but it... Whoever that listener is, please let us know.
Give us your name,
what
your
you were doing when you thought of that.
But
wow.
We didn't even really have like a list of applications when we started doing this whole project. It was sort of like as it came about. It was like
limitless.
Oh man, yeah. And people ask us, and we like rattle off these things that we feel like we've known for years, but really we just discovered in the past 6 months.
Last night.
Yeah. Well, don't go anywhere because we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to hang out again with the girls of Maiden Preserves. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out and I'll lay your ship, babe. See, I'll leave with every piece of you. Don't underestimate the things that I will do. There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing me out the dark.
I got a look, my man, when me no cater for that. Ain't no competition, come no good in the sack. Me no for use my tongue, I'm no afraid of back shot. And me no for rotate it when they put me pants up. Me not like the freaky, so use the hot box. Tie you up on the bed, do a walk, you relax. Then they can ride and give you muscle contract. So no man could have never said, Cecile, you are.
Eat, we have a fear.
We could have had it.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Greenhorn Radio, hosted by Severin von Scharner Fleming, every Thursday at 2 p.m. Greenhorn Radio is radio for young farmers by young farmers. Helmed by acclaimed activist, farmer, and documentarian Severin Fleming, Greenhorn Radio is a weekly phone interview session surveying America's cutting-edge under 40 farmers. Again, that's every Thursday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Helen Holliman. If you liked that jam, that was Adele and Jamie XX, Rollin' in the Heat, which is a remix of Rollin' in the Deep, and it's really hot outside, so I thought that was appropriate. I'm hanging out with the girls of Maiden Preserves, Eva and Allison. You still here?
Hello.
You're very here.
Before we do anything, you should probably go ahead and take a look at maidenpreserves.com because there's some really incredible photographs of their jams.
Our friend Avery Powell took those. We actually met her in ceramics class.
Avery Powell. Hey, girl.
We're
great
partners.
Job.
Life partners.
All walks of life.
You all share a love of cats. That's enough. Enough said. I get it. So yeah, you guys again are at the Flea every weekend, and I want to move into an interesting roundtable topic about the Brooklyn Flea. Mm-hmm. There, you know, the Flea has become kind of this, I don't want to say incubator, but like a nursery bed for small brands that can sometimes bloom into like a bigger business or a bigger offset into a large market. There's now a bunch of, you know, successful chefs and craftsmen of food. I hate using that term.
Craftsmen
that whittle the wood of food. That doesn't make sense. Who are being drawn to the Brooklyn Flea. Why do you think that's happening? And what do you think makes the Brooklyn Flea an incubator for small businesses?
I mean, it's a central location, number one. You get everything you could possibly ever want on a Saturday morning in one spot. And I think people realize that it's kind of a destination for some. I've been going every week, give and take a few weeks, for the past, I don't know, 2 months now. And I see people every weekend. There's one man who comes and hits every booth every Saturday. It's mind-blowing to me, but you realize that for some, this is their weekend. This is their thing that they go do. And I think for that reason, a lot of chefs and a lot of small companies are really drawn to it because you know that you have a built-in audience. You have built-in customers.
Yeah. I think aside from that, like the obvious, like huge client base that's already, like you said, built in, it's really nice to be among your peers in terms of like having the support of other people that you're like, how did you do this? You know, like, what did you do before? Like, how did you get here? And to sort of be able to talk to people, like the amount of other vendors that we've made friends with and sort of gotten advice from and been able to bounce ideas off of. And it's just like a really nurturing community. And I think it invites the type of person or the type of business or business owner that wants to be in that community. You know, it's not like a, this is mine and mine only, and I'm not going to share atmosphere, which I feel like is really old school in terms of food thought, competitiveness in restaurants and restaurant owners and chefs and like being a badass. And I think it's taken a new shape, a gentler shape.
Yeah, it's so
more
it's lovable very, shape. Very communal. And all of the vendors are so friendly, and it's great being around like-minded people.
It sounds like the 60s, love and happiness.
It's just like a great
It's like a beautiful thing, man. Just like live on a commune and grow some alfalfa sprouts.
Something special. Yeah.
Sounds great. So,
and moving on.
So is what kind of cross-pollination have you seen at this incubator? Has any occurred? Like, are there any collaborations? Are you thinking about doing any collaborations with other businesses that are there?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think a lot of people do, actually, especially in the beginning days of Smorgasburg. There were a lot of farmers there, less so now, but unfortunately. But people would use, you know, the goods that the farmers would bring in their products and feature them the next week, which we have done and are doing this week as well. Also, I Eat New York makes this bomb ricotta, and we are going to be using that in sort of just like little snacks next weekend. And, you know, it's, you know, that sort of vibe where like they come over and give us a free sandwich, and we're like moved to sort of make a snack from that and support them and promote them, and they'll be excited about us and what we're doing, and it's really nice.
Does anyone ever get jealous that you're cheating on them when you cross-pollinate these things? Or
I mean, it is a commune, right? So it's free love.
It's free love.
It's free love.
It's, you know, everyone knows that
we
that
have
happens.
So much to give. We have just so much.
So much love.
I'm thinking of a lot of cheesy songs right now.
Were you talking? Okay.
I'm thinking of Free Love Highway from The Office. Does anyone know that song? All right. So, you know, the Triborough area, particularly Brooklyn, is repping a lot of things with the moniker artisan. I said it. Ooh. I know. We've got pickles, saltwater taffy, beef jerky jam, granola. I mean, you name it, it's probably
everything.
Handmade and handcrafted. It's wonderful. Why do you think, you know, also to back up, a lot of the people that are making these things are young people. Why do you think young people are so drawn to crafting these things, and why are they choosing one thing? Are they, it's just sort of why young people? Why this? Why now? Why here?
I think it's because why? That's a very broad question, but
why?
I think it's something that's new and exciting for a lot of people. And I know we were kind of talking about this the other day, more casually, but I think that it harkens back to a lot of people's, you know, youth or where they came from. Like, not so much for me, but I know for Eva, a lot of the things that she loved growing up or saw growing up and felt she wants to sort of, well, not that I'm speaking for you.
Well, no, I
tell
think
them.
It's less of a new thing. I think that it's been ingrained in these people. And I mean, obviously you don't know their background, but for me, it was, I grew up, if you needed a vegetable, you walked out to the backyard and you picked it from the garden. Yeah. If you needed
herbs.
I went
to Ralph's.
If you needed flowers, if you, you know, wanted a cup of sugar that you didn't have, you walked down the dirt road to your neighbor, you bartered, traded, gave him a hug, and then went back home. It was just all
very... Did you
very...
grow up in the 1700s?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I did. You grew up in like an Amish actually... community or something.
I think
it sounds magical.
It just, I think it already exists, and a lot of people have found an outlet through which they can create these goods, and it's not something that they're stumbling upon now. It's something that I think a lot of people have wanted to do, and maybe now they have the ability to do so.
I also think the demand has changed.
Yeah.
You know, people, I think, as a whole, the culture, especially living in New York, especially Brooklyn, there's more demand for this sort of thing. And people are excited by it. And it brings people together. And there's parties around it. There's, you know, there's radio programs about it.
Hey.
Hey, girl. And I think that instead of, you know, becoming a musician or making films, this is sort of like a different art form for people of being creative. And it's, you know, just like that. I just think it's more readily available in the things that...
I think it's been around, too. It's just now it's getting a little more publicity. And, I mean, it's definitely... It has a bigger presence, but it's always existed. Mm-hmm. It's just now people are kind of picking up on it.
What are your thoughts on... I mean, there's certain people at the Flea and at other locations that are creating products that, like, had an office job and are suddenly... They had no background and are suddenly making these wonderful things. So, like... What do you think is up with that?
Go. Be free. Do it. Do it as often as
free
much
love.
As you can.
Yeah. Free
love. Go get it. I mean, coming from someone who did exactly that, I am obviously extremely biased, mm-hmm. but more power to you.
So if our grandparents, well, some mine aren't alive, but let's back up and say our great grandparents. Totally not a Debbie Downer moment, right. I promise. Aww. You know, like people that are from a very old era who are no longer walking around. If they came back and walked into the Brooklyn Flea or like another place and saw our state of culinary affairs within the youth, you know, focus, what do you think they'd be impressed? Would they be like,
they'd
oh,
be like,
great.
This is expensive, y'all. Damn. They're like,
yeah. Do you think they'd be like, cool, I know how to jam that too?
I think they'd be
too,
like, this or? Is what I do
yeah,
anyway.
I think they'd be like, I woke up and did that yesterday.
Yeah, I've like, been up since 3 a.m. making granola
and fermenting
pickles. I've been
churning butter.
Pickles.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Although, I don't, I mean, the reason I ask is, I mean, there's clearly a difference between then and now. Or maybe not, because we weren't there. We weren't there at
you
the
don't
time.
Know.
I don't even know. But what? How are young people like making a twist on these items? What are you guys, for example, doing that is maybe a little different than what grandma made or what people have made in the past?
I think we're a little less homemade. Our whole aesthetic is meant to be very streamlined and chic.
Oh God! Did you just say chic? We did not rehearse
this.
She did not ask me about that. I think that they made jams out of necessity. They made preserves out of necessity. Pickles and beef jerky and all of these things were made as a way to basically feed your family for 6 months.
Through the winter, yeah.
And now people are doing it in a little bit more relaxed time frame. They don't have to do it within a certain number of days or, you know, everyone's going to starve. And I think that, I don't know. I mean, we don't...
It's like a luxury, maybe.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Before it was necessity, and now you're saying it's sort of a luxury.
Correct.
Okay. That was a good answer. That was my...
A little clumsy.
That was my Fox News crossfire question for you. Just to create some controversy. So here's another doozy of a question. This is probably going to be one of my last questions for you. A lot of big cities, San Francisco, Seattle, LA, New York, Austin, represent, have great, great markets, like food markets, and the Brooklyn Flea is an example of that here, that have these incredible opportunities for young businesses and food and what have you. What do you say to places, to smaller cities in America, where this is not happening? This is not, they don't have... these kinds of markets, or they're not crafting one artisanal product, but maybe they do have the resources, and maybe they have better resources, better access to beehives and better access to cheese and milk and whatever.
Yeah.
Why aren't they doing this?
It takes one person to get the idea going. All it takes is one spark. Maybe they just feel like there wouldn't be a demand for it.
Yeah, I feel like all those people move away to all those aforementioned cities, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel like there's sort of this, well, nobody understands, and they flee to go somewhere.
It's like the, how Not many intended. People do you know that you've met in New York that are actually from New York?
Right. It's a city
That
of,
old game that we like to play.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I think that if people, as they get older, maybe will move back to where they're from. I mean, this is my dream, that people move back to where they're from and then sort of continue on what they've been doing to prove it to be successful in those other towns and cities that maybe haven't caught on yet.
So do you think that a food revolution across America is about to happen once all the New Yorkers leave?
I mean, I feel like it's been happening for 15, 20 years. I think that it's a gradual
It's definitely smaller scale. I think it exists on a smaller scale. There isn't like the Minnesota flea.
Mm-hmm. Think about Chez Panisse how many years ago and how people were like, well, how come nobody else is doing this? And now a lot of people are doing it in different cities, and it's sort of raised the bar, you know? And I think that that's going to continue to happen, is that the bar is just going to keep getting raised and that people are going to want certain things and the demand will be met.
All I can say is, girls, keep raising the bar, because you have set it really high. These women have some of the best preserves I've ever tasted. Again, it's called Maiden Preserves. I put the lemon vanilla jam in a cocktail, my lazy vodka gimlet. It takes like 2 seconds. All I needed was like a kiddie pool on a rooftop and my landlord to stop yelling at me, and it would have been
the best day of your life.
It would have been the best day. It would have been the best hippie commune on this side of some utopia. Anyways, there you have it, people. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much to the ladies, Allison and Eva of Maiden Preserves, maidenpreserves.com. Tune in next week to another episode of You Look Hungry. I'm Helen Holliman. Thanks to Jack Inslee, the folks at Roberta's, and Heritage Radio Network. See you later.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. Removing barriers to better quality locally raised meats is one step further along the process. The Niche Meat Processor Assistance Network, or NMPAN, is connecting people across the country with information, tools, and each other. The organization is part of the Cooperative Extension Systems Extension, an internet-based collaborative learning service that consolidates the resources of the land-grant universities. The NMPAM affiliates are now available in almost 40 states and allow the co-coordinators to link people who need help with those who can offer it, such as extension staff members, state departments of agriculture, and markets with experience in small meat processing. They offer webinars, business plans, and hands-on help for processors or wannabe processors. More information is offered at their website, www.nichemeatprocessing.org. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Saturday, July 23rd, Bushwick Block Party.
Block Party.
It's a party in the street.
Free pizza by Roberta.
Death Killer Death Wrestling.
Featuring the legendary Mad Dog Tosto.
Photo Booth by Ryan Slack.
Waterworld.
Closed by
Chimera Dactyl.
Mary Meyer.
Warren Bogart.
Death Killer.
Asphalt Resistant Jeans.
All types of food for your face.
Sweet soda by
P&A.
Roberta's Bake Sale.
Heritage Foods
USA.
Orange Chaney Eating Contest
by the Orange Chaney Brothers.
Live music by
Alex Trujan.
Florida
Paper Twin.
Gang Sign.
The Netherlands.
Team Robespierre.
Wild Yak.
MC Todd and Bo Breezy.
Night Show.
Yeah.
Sponsored by
Martin Greenfield Clothers.
Free Fitness Studio.
Heritage Radio Network.
Free Williamsburg.
6 Point Beer.
Momo's
Sushi Shack.
Beer Box
USA.
Planet of the Bates.
Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street.
All day long.
Finger on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexi-Q, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Computer Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors: Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.